You know, the worst scenario is a quantum computer comes online when there is no safety. All of the current locking scripts and signature schemes that are used in Bitcoin for people to protect their funds are going to become at risk. We've never encountered an issue before where a change to the protocol was done under the necessity for people to actually move their funds. I think that it's exponentially more complicated and difficult for us to come to consensus about how to solve this problem. If this turns into an exponential acceleration, we can expect likely millions of Bitcoin eventually to...
This episode of Supply Shock is brought to you by Ledin, a proud Bitcoin-only company and the global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending. Need cash but don't want to sell down your Bitcoin stack? Ledin has a trusted track record in providing liquidity. That's Ledin. You'll hear more about them later in this episode.
As always, investments in blockchain technology involve risk. Terms and conditions may apply. Do your own research. Quick reminder, nothing said on Supply Shock is a recommendation to buy or sell any investment or product. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and the views expressed by anyone on the show are solely their opinions, not financial advice or necessarily the views of Blockworks. Our hosts, guests, and the Blockworks team may hold positions in the company, sponsor, or projects discussed. Hey everybody, Pete Rizzo, the Bitcoin historian on X, here with a new episode of Supply Shock. We've got a great guest today. You know him, Jameson Lopp, author of a new Bitcoin improvement proposal focused on the quantum computing space. Of course, a lot of fear, uncertainty, doubt in the Bitcoin and wider crypto ecosystem about the looming threat of quantum computing, this idea that advanced computers might be able to break the core cryptographic elements that undermine this new financial system that we're all building. Jameson, of course, a veteran of the space, a Bitcoin legend in his own right, a founder and sort of leader at Casa currently, as well as having contributed to other industry titans like BitGo. Jameson, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here. It's actually the perfect podcast to talk about this because I am specifically trying to prevent a supply shock.
Well, let's dive in there. So quantum computing, we've seen at least one BIP. This was a conversation largely kind of spearheaded by Hunter Beast, who kind of came out of nowhere in the Bitcoin core development community, released a BIP where he started to think through how it would look if the Bitcoin network sort of mass migrated to new addresses that were, quote, quantum resistant, right? So it had some ability to withstand a cryptographic attack. So maybe you can start, just give us, you know, when did you learn about BIP360 and some of this quantum work? Have you been interested in it beforehand? Or was that really the opening salvo to your ultimately advancing that proposal?
I saw when it came in last year, I think, on the mailing list. And I forget the specific time frame, but I know that I gave my first quantum-related presentation about a year ago. I think that was after the initial Bitcoin improvement proposal from Hunter. It definitely got me thinking. We've talked about quantum kind of in passing over the years as this vague theoretical threat that could someday emerge. And I think the main difference of what's happening now is that over the past few years, we've just seen a lot more capital flowing into the quantum computing development and innovation area. So that, of course, has resulted in a space race of sorts between a number of tech giants and a number of new startups that have kind of appeared out of nowhere, generally, you know, backed by people who are very deep in the like quantum physics space, and now they're trying to take theory and turn it into practical reality. So there's still a lot of open questions, of course, but I would say the fear or the concern is that we're not entirely sure whether the progress and the acceleration of innovation in this space is going to be linear, or if it's going to be exponential and potentially catch us by surprise. So obviously we prefer not to be caught by surprise.
Well, maybe let me start with the classic rebuttal. This has been sort of what Bitcoin defenders like you and myself have put forth to CNBC and sort of the mainstream. Michael Saylor kind of, you know, famously going on CNBC and saying, you know, quantum is not a threat. By the time, you know, the cryptography that underlies government systems and that's used in Bitcoin is cracked, there'll be some solution for it. So sort of, you know, coming to market with this idea that, you know, maybe the government won't allow those type of computing to happen because it might face its own threats. It sounds like you disagree with that assessment.
Yeah, well, the government, quote unquote, like there is no one world government, right? So even if, for example, the United States implemented some sort of major crackdown, restriction, regulation, whatever, they can't stop what's happening in China. They can't stop what's happening in Russia. Though really, I think it is mostly going to be between China and America at this point. We had a lot of deep conversations this past week at the Presidio Quantum Bitcoin Summit, where we were talking about how it seems like most of the development in the United States is happening via private companies. And most of the development that's happening in China is also via private companies. However, there's not really much distinction between private companies in China and the government of China. So it is, you could argue more effectively, the Chinese government that is a potential threat actor here. You know, technology continues to progress, and this is kind of one of the main thesis behind Bitcoin itself, right, is that governments can't stop technology. They can do things to try to slow it down, but ultimately it will route around any form or attempt at censorship. So I think the best thing to do is to expect that we will continue seeing progress being made and do whatever we can to be proactive and put plans in place so that you know, we don't have a catastrophic issue just come out of left field.
So we've got this idea of this looming two-day threat, right? Maybe that's accelerating. Maybe it's being celebrated by private investment. Now we have sort of, okay, maybe the government can't stop this because of the jurisdictions and sort of the regional diversification, as you're saying. So the Presidio conference, was this a conversation largely about technical proposals about how to deal with this? So this would be essentially, as your BIP does, sort of codifying some way to handle this network-wide. And so was the conference mostly focused on just that idea that the Bitcoin development community might have to respond or is responding?
I mean, a large part of it was trying to get a better grasp around quantifying the imminence of the threat. So, you know, we had presentations not only from Bitcoin developers talking about potential solutions, but from cryptographers and from people who are actually building the quantum computers that may be able to eventually crack the ECDSA, the cryptography that is used.
What did they, what did they say? Did they present sort of like a bull case of where they were sort of very bullish on these quantum computers being able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, they're incentivized to be bullish on it, you know, as any sort of startup would be. You saw a few different charts. The short version is that in terms of the current computing power of quantum computers, we are several orders of magnitude away from the amount of compute that would be required in order to run Shor's algorithm, which is the algorithm that makes cracking this type of cryptography extremely cheap compared to using a classical computer to try to, you know, brute force a private key that matches a public key.
Right, real quick clarification, is Shor different than Schnorr signatures? Because we have Schnorr signatures in Bitcoin, there's a difference there?
Yes. There are a number of overlaps that can make it a bit confusing because Shor's algorithm also applies to cracking Schnorr signatures because it also uses elliptic curve cryptography. So really what it is all of the current locking scripts and signature schemes that are used in Bitcoin for people to protect their funds are going to become at risk. And there's a number of different vectors, whether it's long range attacks or short range attacks. But ultimately, assuming that a quote unquote cryptographically relevant quantum computer ends up being built, that basically means a quantum computer that has enough qubits and error correction and really computing power to be able to run this algorithm in a human time frame, you know, hours, days, weeks, what have you, then that's when we would expect that that would create the economic incentive for people to try to start scooping up vulnerable coins.
So most of your work to date is kind of focused, again, on this ethical question. So there's this idea, and maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, how certain we are that this general kind of idea is correct. But so essentially, there's this idea that we have to find some way to migrate Bitcoin to quantum resistant addresses, right? That is the sort of the best way to attack the problem. Maybe we can kind of step outside that and like look at the problem surface for a second. So like, why is that right now kind of the preferred like area of research? Because I know both Hunter's proposal and your proposal kind of focuses on this idea of kind of upgrading the wallet addresses. They call it the hodler's dilemma. Ever wish you could get access to cash without selling down your stack? Well, Ledin makes that possible. Since 2018, Ledin has issued over $9 billion worth of Bitcoin-backed loans, and they haven't lost a single Satoshi of client funds in the process. There are no credit checks. You can get funds in under 12 hours and repay whenever you want with zero penalties. Unlike others, Ledin doesn't lend out your collateral. They even publish biannual proof of reserves verified by top auditors in the blockchain. You can learn more at ledin.io. That's ledin.io.
As always, investments in blockchain technology involve risk. Terms and conditions may apply. Do your own research.
Well, I would say there's actually a distinction. My proposal has nothing to do with what post-quantum cryptographic scheme we might implement, because this is a really gnarly problem, and I'm not a cryptographer, and I don't even want to throw my hat in the arena, because I've evaluated the current algorithms that are out there for post-quantum cryptography, and they frankly all suck. Or at least they all suck in terms of Bitcoin and the resource and throughput, you know, and data limitations of Bitcoin. Essentially, all of these cryptographic schemes that are quantum safe are orders of magnitude larger in terms of the key size and signature size. And they're often also orders of magnitude slower in terms of verifying. So like all of those things are, of course, are considerations and trade-offs that are going to go into the debate around how do we secure the Bitcoin protocol from quantum computers. Now, we saw presentations from a variety of developers who looked at ways where you could come up with reasonably secure solutions that actually don't use any of these fancy post-quantum cryptographic algorithms and rather just rely upon using cryptographic hashes. Cryptographic hashes are also safe from quantum compute as long as you have not, you know, exposed the underlying data that is being hashed. And I think we saw both Roast Beef and Taj Dryja submit proposals for ways to do that. And these also have different trade-offs. All of these things have trade-offs. Now, the hash-based ones tend to be better on like the amount of resources that are required, but you often end up losing the ability to do other things that the Bitcoin protocol can currently do. So like I said, there's no perfect...
I like the hashed one where you'd end up sending coins to a hash and sort of using that as some sort of method for...
Yeah, so Roast Beef's... if I recall correctly, his proposal would basically involve creating much more complex Merkle trees and proofs and like very, very deep multiple sets of hashes that give you additional quantum resistance. This is going to make it, of course, more complicated to actually manage those schemes. There's probably additional data that you would need to hold on to. Taj had a commit and reveal scheme that was not quite as complicated, but requires doing more on-chain proofs where basically you would have to post a proof on chain and then wait some period of time, and then you would be able to actually spend the coins. And you know, that gave you a resistance against long range attacks, but not necessarily short range attacks. Like I said, all of these things have trade-offs, and I don't like any of them particularly, because you end up giving up something. So my proposal kind of sets all of that gnarly debate to the side. And my proposal actually starts off saying, okay, we assume that we have come to consensus on what post-quantum crypto scheme we're going to implement. Looking forward from there, how do we deal with the incentive?
Yeah, sort of the upgrading, right?
But because that's only step one. Step two is, how do we actually get everybody to migrate? We've never encountered an issue before where a change to the protocol was done under the necessity for people to actually move their funds. And as we know, things move very slowly in the Bitcoin ecosystem. It takes years to get a proposal from the initial rough draft all the way through the review process, the activation process. Even once it gets activated at the protocol level, it then takes many years after that for the code to be turned into libraries, to matriculate throughout the ecosystem, to get adopted by all of the infrastructure providers and the wallet software and the hardware key managers and so on and so forth. And the short version is, this is why we are talking about this today when there is no imminent threat of quantum computing. It's because we preferably want to get this kicked off like 5 to 10 years before it becomes an imminent threat, if we want to be able to get the entire ecosystem in consensus with each other and adopting the technology and moving the funds. Moving the funds alone, just from a block space throughput perspective, would take anywhere from several months to potentially many years or unlimited amount of time, because obviously nobody can be forced to do anything that they don't want to.
Well, then, if I understand your proposal correctly, it sort of lays out the timeline under which, you know, some people would no longer be able to kind of move those older coins, or there'd be certain narrow set of conditions under which they would move. So maybe let's talk into, this is the larger problem set, right? In order to solve this problem, we're going to need to kind of move some of these coins or have people voluntarily move the coins. Can you talk a little bit about how this proposal like specifically attacks that problem? And let's say in the case of like Satoshi's Bitcoins, right? So, you know, estimated 1.1 million Bitcoins sitting there, you know, if no one was to move those coins, they would essentially be frozen, correct?
That's the idea. Now, of course, this is controversial, and I wrote a fairly lengthy essay back in March, several months ago, explaining what I thought all of the points of contention would be and kind of my counterpoints to those. If we're in the do-nothing crowd of, even if we roll out the post-quantum scheme, but we decide, well, this is only going to be opt-in voluntary only, and we're not going to incentivize people to move their funds and tell them that they're going to have problems if they don't, then we can expect likely millions of Bitcoin eventually to be scooped up by a quantum capable adversary and most likely dumped on the market. There's many variables at play here, and that's what a lot of the discussion we had at the summit was around, was like all of these different potential scenarios. So especially, you know, the worst scenario is a quantum computer comes online when there is no safety, there is no post-quantum cryptography available. In that type of scenario, if a quantum attacker starts scooping up coins, then they're most likely going to want to dump them as expediently as possible, because they can't even protect their own coins, you know, that they are saving, at least from short range attacks when they're moving them. But to get back to my actual proposal, the idea is that First, if we've activated some sort of post-quantum scheme, then we let that sit for a few years. And then after 3 years, we actually start rejecting transactions if people are trying to send coins to vulnerable scripts. Now, the reason for that is there is no way to, you know, email every Bitcoin user. There's no way to reliably notify every Bitcoin user that they need to take action, that they need to upgrade their security of their wallet, of their coins, and so on and so forth. So I figure after 3 years, it's a somewhat liberal, aggressive timeline to get the entire ecosystem upgraded from a software standpoint. But after 3 years, if people are then trying to send money and their transactions are getting rejected, I figure that's going to cause them to look deeper into what is going on. And at that point in time, they will figure out, hey, there's this whole quantum migration that's happening. I need to change the software. I need to change the attributes of my wallet so that I will be safe. Then the next phase that I've proposed is essentially 2 years after that point. So 5 years after the initial activation of a post-quantum cryptographic scheme, that is when we start rejecting all transactions that are spending quantum vulnerable funds. So the idea there is to completely cut off the capability of a quantum adversary from being able to scoop up funds and create massive economic disruption across the network. Now, this, of course, is controversial because people who weren't paying attention could get locked out of their funds. Now, the final phase, and I'm hoping that with enough research and development, this can actually occur in conjunction with the rejection of spending quantum vulnerable funds, is that I think it's preferable for us to come up with a quantum safe recovery scheme that people who have funds in those quantum vulnerable scripts can then provide some additional proof that they are the true owner and not a quantum attacker. And you know, there's a variety of ways that you could do this, but essentially I think it's going to involve using some data from your seed phrase, essentially, your hierarchical deterministic wallet. There should be ways where we can implement a zero knowledge scheme that you essentially feed your seed phrase into and your derivation path into, and you prove that you have this additional data that a quantum attacker would not have about, you know, the root keys to your wallet that are then used to derive the other keys. Because a quantum attacker would only be able to look at the blockchain and get the specific private key for your funds. They wouldn't be able to get all of the parent keys that you're using to derive that key from. So that needs some work, but it should theoretically be possible.
Okay, so just running it through more time. I know this was kind of like the, you know, a bit of an acid test for Bitcoin development in the past, which is this idea that, you know, if you go into a coma, right? That was sort of during like the Ethereum debates and sort of the hard forks. There was this idea that Bitcoin development was really building for this worst case scenario. You know, you're an evicted from your country. You're on the run for a couple of years. You don't know what's happening. You know, you're the last soldier in Vietnam who's still fighting the Vietnam War. You know, you're the guy who goes into a coma and you wake up 20 years later and you need to get your Bitcoin. So in that case, it seems like your proposal, it's like there's still edge cases where some good faith Bitcoin user potentially could face an adversarial or difficult situation if we were to do one of these schemes.
Yeah, the biggest problem, assuming that we come up with this recovery scheme that I'm envisioning, the biggest problem and edge case would be people who are not using hierarchical deterministic wallets. So that should still be a very tiny number of people. But, you know, if, for example, you have a Casatius coin, if you have like one of those really old paper wallets that's literally just one private key, it's not a seed phrase or you know, XPub that you drive.
Right, Satoshi wouldn't have, let's just assume Satoshi like would have none of that, right? Based on what we know about where their wallets were generated. Right?
Satoshi, if they're still around, hopefully is paying attention and would have plenty of years ahead of them to be able to move funds if necessary.
Interesting. And so what kind of feedback did you get at the summit on this proposal? As you mentioned, there was a couple of controversial areas. What was the reception?
Let's take a quick break to talk about today's sponsor, Ledin, the most trusted name in Bitcoin-backed lending. Look, if you're like me, you never really want to think about selling your Bitcoin. Ledin has a solution. You can borrow against your Bitcoin. No credit checks, no monthly payments, no hidden fees. You can get your cash in under 12 hours and pay back when you want, zero penalties. Unlike other platforms, Ledin has a history of transparency. They prove it with independent proof of reserves audits every 6 months on the blockchain. In total, they've issued more than $9 billion in loans without losing a single Satoshi of client funds. That's the kind of track record you want when it comes to securing your Bitcoin. You can learn more. Visit ledn.io. That's ledn.io.
As always, investments in blockchain technology involve risk. Terms and conditions may apply. Do your own research.
I would say it's actually been less controversial than I expected. You know, there have been a handful of people who just say, well, you know, you can't violate this inviolable principle of Bitcoin. And as I outlined a number of months ago in my essay, if a cryptographically relevant quantum computer does come online, then inviolable properties of Bitcoin are going to be violated regardless of what we do or don't do. So it's not a question, I think, of do we support, like you could call it protocol enforced confiscation.
And by that, these inviolable properties, you mean the idea that someone who owns Bitcoin either sort of did the work to mine and receive that Bitcoin or otherwise paid for that Bitcoin, and a quantum attacker sort of invalidates with that, right? They're sort of able to take
the property. The principle of, you know, not your keys, not your coins. The flip side of that is your keys, your coins. And that's the principle that would be violated, because now all of a sudden you have someone who can get your keys simply because they have a technological advantage over everyone else in the world. Or the entire ecosystem decides, well, if you don't upgrade your security, we don't want to accept that a quantum capable adversary could take those keys. And so it's going to become difficult, if not impossible, to actually spend those funds.
In terms of like the mining side, like the quantum mining, I know this has been like a meme for forever, but was that discussed at the session as well, whether like there would actually be mining, you know, machines to be built like on quantum, or how does that factor into what the discussion is at this point?
It wasn't a major point because the concern is not nearly as high, because Shor's algorithm only really applies to reverse engineering a private key from a public key. It can't be used for mining. There is a different algorithm called Grover's algorithm that could be used to improve the efficiency of mining, which is essentially like running the double SHA-256 algorithm. However, the effective speed up is only maybe like a 4x speed up, whereas, you know, Shor's algorithm, we're talking orders of magnitude cheaper. So while you could use quantum computing for mining, it's not going to, I think, result in the same level of return on investment as just crashing.
Okay. So is the idea here that if you are the first quantum computer and you are going to, you know, set your sights on Bitcoin, because the logic of Bitcoin has always been, right, that it's better to go with the majority, right? It's better to kind of dedicate your computing resources to Bitcoin. Here, it would be mathematically, it would be better for this attacker to dedicate their resources towards attacking Bitcoin.
I think so. Now, there are some other discussions that have gone on with regard to how quantum mining might play out. And I think one thing that hasn't been discussed as deeply as it could be is this idea that actually, if you're mining Bitcoin with a quantum computer, you could theoretically be mining arbitrarily long reorganization chains all simultaneously. So that could change some of the game theory around mining. But even then, if you think about like what you could do with a 51% attack, if you could arbitrarily reorganize the chain, you can still only really double spend your own money. So assuming like a quantum attacker is some entity that has put billions of dollars into building their computer, they probably don't have a ton of Bitcoin that they can double spend. They probably just want to reverse engineer private keys and steal other people's coins.
So is the idea with, just assuming that, you know, they're cracking these wallet addresses and private keys, are there estimates on like, because again, I know that I get the general threat, right? The general threat is that you've posted your public address somewhere, these addresses are vulnerable. The attacker can go back and kind of run some sort of calculation. But, you know, obviously not all of these are going to be successes. They have to get that information. Like, do we know, or has anyone estimated sort of like how long that process would, is it days, weeks, months, years? You know, what does it look like?
Well, ultimately it depends on just the timeline for accelerating the usable compute power of a quantum machine. And so that is really the ultimate open question here. If the progress of quantum computing continues linearly, then we'll have a ton of time, and it could be such that the first quantum attacker, you know, takes months or a year to reverse engineer a single key. But if this turns into an exponential acceleration, and the reason why some people are worried about that is there is, for example, a company called PsiQuantum that is building these photonic quantum chips, and they have a $1 billion facility they're building in Chicago that's supposed to come online in 2 to 3 years. And if their thesis is correct and the photonic chips that they're building are stackable on top of each other, where they can all of a sudden, they can just print out the same chip and put 1,000 of them together, and that they just magically all work, without any other trade-offs, then that's the type of thing where you could see a sudden leap forward and, you know, exponential increase in usable quantum compute. But, you know, it's also possible that they do that and then they find out that there's still a lot of like noise and error correction that needs to be done, and so it doesn't scale as well as they thought. But, you know, we won't know until they actually build it and try.
Interesting. So curious for any other final thoughts. Were there any sort of, other interesting things that occurred at the Presidio conference? And I'm just curious, were there plans for sort of like future meetings of this group? Because it does seem like, you know, quantum is becoming, having more of a mind share within Bitcoin these days.
I think the main takeaway is that at least at this point in time, the biggest problem may very well be the fear and uncertainty around quantum computing rather than an actual quantum attacker themselves appearing. I argue that even though we may very well be a decade or more away from a cryptographically relevant quantum computer appearing, just due to the nature of Bitcoin and how complicated this particular problem is, this is not going to be like previous consensus change issues, where it's like one tiny little narrow issue that we're trying to come on consensus about. It's like half a dozen different issues that are all intertwined. So from a consensus standpoint, I think that it's exponentially more complicated and difficult for us to come to consensus about how to solve this problem. So all the more reason to be getting ahead of the curve and talking about it as far in advance as possible.
Let's just say I'm like somebody who's like listening to this conversation concerned. If I migrated to something like a multi-sig, then in most cases, I'm likely okay and protected from a quantum attack. Or are there kind of ideas that, because it seems like there are some addresses that are okay and some that are not. Is there a situation where sort of all these addresses like end up being compromised, or all of these schemes, like even like a multi-sig type setup?
Yeah. So, you know, if people want to know what can I do right now to secure myself and my funds more, it's actually quite simple. Don't reuse Bitcoin addresses. This is like one of the most basic fundamental principles of Bitcoin that I think even Satoshi talked about. And originally, the idea for that was just from a privacy perspective of not linking all your funds into the same address very easily. But it turns out this is actually also applicable to quantum computing, because most of the schemes out there right now, when you deposit funds into the Bitcoin address, it's protected by a hash, and so it's safe. And it's not until you spend funds from the address that you're exposing the public key on the blockchain that then potentially a quantum computer could use to reverse engineer the private key. So as long as you're only ever sending funds to one address at a time, and then when you spend them, you're always sending them to a new address, you have built-in protection against a long-range attack because you're not exposing your public keys on the blockchain. The only caveat to that is the newest form of addresses, the Taproot addresses, are actually exposed by default. We actually kind of went a step backwards with regard to Taproot and quantum security. So as long as you're using any other form of address, you have this hash protection automatically. So just don't send funds to the same address more than one time, and you'll generally be in a much better position.
I want to zoom out a little bit. I know that you're always got your finger on the pulse of what's happening in Bitcoin and the crypto sphere, especially as it relates to kind of these two worlds sort of melding. You know, we've seen a lot over the last couple of years about, you know, Bitcoin layer twos and things like that. We heard a lot about go-to-market timelines. It seems like those have sort of been pushed back, right? We're sort of here in July of 2025. Doesn't seem like there are BitVM implementations running, though we keep hearing that they're, you know, close by. Are you hearing any updates on that, or what are you following out there in the kind of, you know, advanced Bitcoin landscape that's interesting to you?
Well, in terms of BitVM, it sounds like Citria is the furthest along with regard to launching a production network. If you're looking more at the folks that are actively developing BitVM, it seems like a new version of BitVM comes out about every 6 months. So it's hard to say when at the like protocol level, the BitVM development will stop because they feel like it has been sufficiently improved and made more secure and efficient. But yeah, in general, it seems the landscape is continuing to evolve, but all of these things move slowly and take time because if you're putting a lot of money at risk, you want to be quite confident that it's going to be safe and the game theory is going to work out the way that you want. Another example of that is Botanix, for example. They launched their production network recently, but the initial launch is it's a federation. They have yet to get to the point where they are actually confident enough, I think, in the game theory around this concept of the spider chain, which is really like a set of rolling multi-sigs that would be controlling the peg in and peg out from that layer two.
And so, you know, I know since we last chatted around April or maybe even February, I think it might have been, there's a lot that's happened in sort of the Bitcoin development world. I had Jeff Garzik on and Peter Todd recently kind of talking about the upheaval around the Bitcoin Core development process or the latest with, you know, Bitcoin Core and a lot of users migrating to Knots, right? We've seen about 10% of the network kind of migrate to, you know, some sort of other alternative Bitcoin implementation. Where are you and your thoughts about what is going on there and larger takeaways around it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a knee-jerk reaction to the like op return and spam and filtering debate stuff, which was expected. I do find it interesting, and I'm tracking some of the metrics around that. Let's just say it's interesting that at least over the past month or so, it seems like the majority of the new quote unquote Knots nodes that are coming online are Tor only nodes. Let's just say some of them might belong to me.
Okay, and this is just your way of kind of tracking the analytics on the network, or are you?
No, I was interested to see how manipulable the metrics are, because in general, counting nodes is pretty ridiculous, because what we're really talking about is opening up the potential for Sybil attacks. Running a node that is picked up by any of these node counting explorers does not actually prove that whatever is accepting that network connection and identifying itself as a node is in fact a unique standalone node like run by one person. one thing that I started looking into was how many quote unquote nodes can I get to show up on these node counting dashboards that are actually just one machine that I'm running with many, many different interfaces, network interfaces on top of it.
Interesting. Well, I'll wait for that blog post, but just in terms of the, you know, general kind of idea, right? We've seen some demand for like an alternative development process. It doesn't seem like that has led to anything formalized. You know, is this a closed issue in your view, or do you think we're still going to keep, you know, hearing about this?
Well, I mean, one thing that I've said a few times is that, you know, I think that more Bitcoin client diversity is good. I just don't think Knots offers the diversity that people should be looking for. If people want to run non-core Bitcoin clients, I would point them to either Floresta or BTCD, because those are the most actively developed alternative Bitcoin clients that actually have teams of people behind them. You know, I'm also a fan of LibBitcoin, but there's only like one or two guys working on that as well. So like, if you want an alternative client, then you need to be looking at the software development lifecycle. You know, how many people are actually reviewing the code that is going into that client? Because that is the fundamental security requirement for any open source project, is like number of eyes looking at the code. And while you know, Luke and certain Knots proponents reject the claim that there's only one person looking at the code on Knots, you can go onto the GitHub and look at exactly how the commits are going in, and you know how many different individuals are contributing code to Knots, and ultimately it's one guy. And so it does not have the same robustness in the software development lifecycle as Bitcoin Core. It's ultimately a one-man project, and I would love to see them actually get more developers actively contributing to it and enforcing rules on their GitHub that require more than one person to review and sign off on the code. Like, that would give me more confidence in the quality of the code that is being shipped there.
Time for one more question here. This is more of a statement, but John Carvalho tweeting out this morning, he said that his view, the Bitcoin blockchain was healthier and more exciting when there was spam on the blockchain. Obviously, right now we're back, you know, at historically low levels of fees, you know, at a time where Bitcoin demand seems very robust, right? We've got, you know, Trump media going out and buying, by some estimates, 18,000 Bitcoin, kind of stacking on the balance sheet, you know, not nary any evidence on chain. You know, what do you think about this idea that maybe we're actually not progressing and we're kind of moving backwards in what's happening on chain?
Well, obviously, from running a self-custody company, I'm not a fan of the trend of what we're seeing. It's a lot of consolidation and centralization of Bitcoin into the hands of just a few institutional custodians. I think that that is a large explanation for why the mempool is empty and why fees are so low. And ultimately, this is kind of a game theory issue that unless there is, it's not just that there needs to be significant demand for Bitcoin or for financial exposure to Bitcoin, it's that the fundamental premise and the game theory of securing Bitcoin as a system, at least from a thermodynamic security level, which is saying paying the miners to keep hashing to make it difficult and expensive to double spend, that requires demand for sovereign usage of Bitcoin, which is another way of saying self-custody, where like you're actually using the Bitcoin protocol, you're actually using the blockchain and the network to make these transfers of value. If too many people are just updating IOUs and centralized databases through, you know, traditional finance interfaces, then that is not creating demand for block space, which ultimately is detrimental to the revenue and profits and incentives for miners to secure the network. So it's not great from that perspective. I'm hopeful that more development, both at layer twos and layer one, will result in people building more things on top of Bitcoin that can drive more demand for sovereign use. But at this point in time, I don't like the trend that we seem to be going in. So hopefully we can reverse that. But it's not helpful when you have the dominant narrative being never go up, and then one of the other dominant narratives being ossification of, you know, Bitcoin is perfect. We don't need to make any changes to the protocol because making changes to the protocol is riskier than not making changes.
Jefferson, always great to have you. Lop.net, of course, a great educational resource. We encourage people to check out Casa. Myself, a Casa user, my Bitcoin protected and the nice multi-sig. Definitely recommend that. Anything else you'd like for direct listeners too, while you have the time?
No, I mean, I think my main takeaway, both from the summit this past week and in general with what a lot of the discussions are that we've been having recently, is that the greatest threat to Bitcoin is not quantum computing or even any of the TradFi stuff going on. The greatest threat long-term to Bitcoin is apathy. And so as long as we just continue discussing Bitcoin and its potential weaknesses or points for potential improvement, that's how we keep progressing forward. You know, one step in at a time, one foot in front of the other. It's not until we all sit down and say, okay, you know, Bitcoin is perfect and done, that I think it ends up being at the greatest risk of failing.
Of course, the discussion on this and more will continue. We'll be at Digital Asset Summit later this year. Join the Blockworks team there. You go to blockworks.co, learn more about the exciting content going on there. I'll be there bringing a Bitcoin perspective on the crypto industry as it gathers in the UK. And if you're getting the email, so once again, reminder, Supply Shock email coming out daily. We've got a reader survey there offering some nice gifts and prizes for those who fill that out. We'll be back next week. For now, this has been Supply Shock, Blockworks Podcast.